Chapter 2. A Bottle of Champagne. The carriage stopped outside the Vauxhall, and our passengers got out.
"Oh, Dobbin," said George, "can you look after the coats, my good man?"
While the others made their way into the gardens, Dobbin made sure the coats were in a safe place and paid at the door for the whole group. Then he walked modestly behind the others. Seeing Amelia walking with his friend George Osborne, a thought came into his mind. Maybe he would like to have something on his arm besides some coats. But Dobbin didn't have a selfish bone in his body, and as long as his friend was enjoying himself, how could he be unhappy? Becky took Joseph's arm while they were walking.
"How I would like to see India," she remarked.
"Really?" replied Joseph. His heart was beating fast.
The two couples arrived at their seats, while Dobbin looked on. He knew that he would be forgotten tonight, and to be alone at the Vauxhall is a very sad experience. So he decided to go for a walk and leave the happy couples to their conversation. Joseph soon forgot how critical the situation was. He started to enjoy himself. He ordered the waiters about with great majesty. He opened the champagne bottle and cut the chicken and ate and drank almost all of it. For most people, that would have been enough. They would have been full, but not Joseph. He decided to order another bottle of champagne. And it was this extra champagne that will change the whole course of this story. Dear reader, you may ask yourself how a bottle of champagne can change destiny. Well, why not? Here is what happened. The young ladies didn't drink the champagne. George didn't like it either, and so Joseph drank it all himself. He became lively, too lively. He began to talk and laugh so loudly that he attracted other listeners at nearby tables. And then, to everybody's horror, he began to sing.
"Bravo, fat one," said one listener.
"Sing another,"
said a man standing next to him. Joseph was becoming a figure of fun, much to the annoyance of George Osborne.
"For heaven's sake, Joseph, we should go," cried George.
The young women rose to leave.
"Stop, my dearest diddle diddle darling," shouted Joseph,
and he grabbed Becky's arm and sat her down again. Joseph continued to drink, to flirt, and to sing, waving his glass gracefully to his growing audience. He invited them to share his champagne. Just as George was about to confront someone who wanted to take advantage of this invitation, who should step in but a gentleman of the name of Dobbin?
"Go away, you fools!" shouted Dobbin,
and the crowd that had gathered disappeared before his fierce words.
"Good heavens, where have you been, Dobbin?" said George. "Make yourself useful and deal with Joseph here, while I take the ladies to the carriage."
Joseph began to object, but soon stopped when he saw George's expression. And so George was able to remove the ladies to safety. Taking Dobbin's hand, Joseph began to confess his love for the girl that had just left.
"I will marry her tomorrow morning at St. George's, Hanover Square. I will wake up the Archbishop of Canterbury if I have to."
The ladies returned to Russell Square, trying to make sense of what had just happened.
"He must propose tomorrow," thought Becky. "He called me his soul's darling 4 times. He grabbed my hand in front of Amelia. He will propose tomorrow."
Amelia was of the same opinion. The next morning, Joseph was groaning in agony on the sofa. He had a terrible headache. George and Dobbin were looking down at him in this state, and they exchanged grins.
"How are you, Joseph?" asked George. No bones broken, I hope.
I behave terribly, replied Joseph.
George had no hesitation in reminding Joseph of everything he had done the night before. He was not too happy with the idea that a member of a family into which he intended to marry should be involved with a simple governess.
Do you remember singing a song? Asked George.
I sang a song, replied Joseph.
On their way out, Dobbin spoke to his friend about being so direct.
You should not have been so hard on him, you know.
Why? Who is this little schoolgirl he is so interested in? I would rather have a lady for my sister-in-law. I am a liberal man, but you know I come from one of the oldest families in England. Becky should know her place.
Becky was waiting anxiously for news of Joseph when George arrived. George described Joseph's condition to the two young ladies, and it was obvious that he was enjoying himself.
It is cruel of you to laugh, said Amelia.
Oh, if you could have seen him this morning, in his flowered dressing gown, groaning on the sofa.
And it was at this point that Becky realised.
This George is no friend of mine, she thought. He has been making fun of me, and he is my enemy. I am sure of that.
Joseph didn't come all day or the next day. The day after that, however, the ladies were sitting on the sofa when a servant arrived with a letter in his hands.
Note from Mr. Joseph, miss, he said.
Amelia trembled as she opened it.
Dear Amelia, please excuse me for my conduct at Vauxhall. I ask you to pardon me for every word I said at the dinner. As soon as I have recovered, for my health is quite bad, I shall go to Scotland for some months.
And so it was all over. Amelia didn't dare to look at Becky's face as she dropped the letter into her lap. And so it was that Becky had to make preparations for her departure. She was to become a governess after all.
It was George Osborne who prevented my marriage, she thought.
Finally, the day came when Becky had to leave for her new job. Amelia and Becky parted, promising to love each other and be friends forever. Becky cried as she left in the carriage. But as soon as the carriage turned the corner, away from Russell Square, she dried her eyes and looked at the letter she had received a few days before.
Sir Pitt Crawley kindly asks Miss Sharp to be here on Tuesday, as I leave for the town of Queen's Crawley tomorrow, early in the morning. Sir Pitt Crawley, Great Gaunt Street, London.
Becky had never seen a baronet before.
I wonder what he will be like, she thought.
I suppose he will be handsomely dressed. He will be very proud, have perfect manners, and I will be treated with contempt.
Well, I shall deal with that. At least I shall be with gentlemen and not with these vulgar city people.
Soon, the carriage arrived at Great Gaunt Street. It stopped in front of a tall, gloomy house. The windows were closed on the first floor, while those of the dining room on the second floor were partially open. The door was opened by a man in short trousers. He wore an old coat, and a dirty neckcloth was tied around his unshaven neck. He had a shiny bald head and a red face.
Is this Sir Pitt Crawley's residence? Asked Becky.
Yes. Come this way, said the man.
The bald-headed man took his hands out of his pockets and carried Becky's belongings into the house. They went into the dining room. The house was dark and dull. The carpets were rolled up, and the pictures were covered with brown paper. The only way one could know that this room was a dining room was by the shape of the covered table and chairs.
Not much of a dining room, thought Becky. On the table there was some bread and cheese. And not much to dine on either.
You've had your dinner, I suppose, said the old man. Do you want some beer? He added.
Where is Sir Pitt Crawley? Asked Becky majestically.
I'm here, responded the bald-headed man.
Becky tried not to look surprised.
I'm here on business, my dear, and that's why I'll have the pleasure of your company tomorrow when you go back to Queen's Crawley. It's time for bed. You'll sleep with my servant Tinker tonight. It's a big bed, and there's room for two. The first Lady Crawley died in it. Good night.
Becky tried not to think of her dirty bed, but she remained awake for a long time, thinking about the new world she was about to enter, and already she began to calculate how much success she would have there. The next morning, Becky found herself in another carriage, on her way to Queen's Crawley in Hampshire. As soon as she arrived, she wasted no time in writing to Amelia.
My dearest, sweetest Amelia, I will not tell you how sad I am to be separated from you. Now I am friendless and alone. Sir Pitt is not what you would imagine a baronet to be like. He is old, short, vulgar and dirty. He is very mean and watches every penny he spends. We arrived at Queen's Crawley yesterday. The house is an old-fashioned mansion with tall chimneys. It is enormous. I think there are at least 20 rooms just on the first floor. The great hall has a large fireplace and... Here I am again, my dear. I was interrupted last night by Sir Pitt Crawley in his dressing gown. He took my candle. He told me that there are no candles after 11 p.m, so I had to stop writing this letter. Anyway, I was telling you about the house. The schoolroom is on the second floor. I will teach Sir Pitt's children there. They are 8 and 10 years old. Sir Pitt has two other children from his first marriage. Half an hour after our arrival, the dinner bell was rung, and I came down to dine. There I met Sir Pitt's second wife, the second Lady Crawley, and the mother of the children I am teaching. She is pale. In fact, she looks quite ill, and she does not speak very much. Then there was Mr. Crawley, one of Sir Pitt's sons from his first marriage. He is pale, thin, ugly and silent. Apparently, he is a very religious man. There is another son from Sir Pitt's first marriage, but I haven't met him yet. Give my love to your dear mother and father, and I hope your brother is feeling better. Ever yours, Becky. Becky finished the letter and thought about her future. Now, I have to make myself agreeable to these people. I have to gain their confidence. I am not as lucky as that pink-faced little girl Amelia, who is not half as clever as me. She has £10,000. Her future is secure. And what do I have? Just my intelligence. I do not dislike Amelia. Who could dislike such a harmless, good-natured creature? But one day I will take my place above her in the world. We have already witnessed Becky's capacity to charm a man. It wasn't long before she used these abilities to charm the people around her at Queen's Crawley. Becky set to work immediately to make herself absolutely indispensable. No task was too much for her. Nothing was too much trouble. Becky didn't worry about Lady Crawley. She seemed to be of no importance whatsoever. But with Mr. Crawley, Becky was respectful and obedient. She consulted him on passages of French that she pretended not to understand, and was often brought to tears by the religious speeches he would make in the evening. Becky found many different ways of being useful to Sir Pitt,
She helped him with business matters. She volunteered to copy many of his letters. And she took an interest in all of his affairs. Before a year had passed, she had won over all the members of the family. The baronet was especially impressed with her, and the conversation at the dinner table was now almost exclusively between Sir Pitt and Miss Becky Sharp. The gossip of the servants at this time was all about Becky.
The new governess is a good manager. Sir Pitt seems very impressed by her. She writes his letters, does his business, and manages his accounts. She has become indispensable. Mr. Crawley seems fond of her too. He's always reading to her from the Bible.
It was Christmas, and some time had passed since Becky's last letter to Amelia. And soon events encouraged her to write again.
Dear Amelia, if I have not written to you for many weeks, it is only because things do not change very much here. Every day is much like the next. For a few days now, something has changed, though. Old Miss Crawley has arrived. She is Sir Pitt's sister, and she is very rich. All of the members of the family are fighting to get her cushions and fetch her coffee. Now we have dinner parties. Just imagine. We never have dinner parties normally. We drink champagne and wine as if it is a normal, everyday occurrence. There are no more limits on the candles, and the house is always warm. Lady Crawley still looks ill, but she wears her best clothes, as do the children. P.S. I have finally met Captain Rawdon Crawley, the mysterious other son. Surprise, surprise, he arrived just after old Miss Crawley. He is tall and very handsome. He has a loud voice and he uses it a great deal. But all the servants adore him because he is generous. He even paid me a compliment the other day. What a pretty little girl she is, I heard him say to some friends. So there were two new people in Becky's life. Two other members of the Crawley family that she had to impress, convince and conquer. Sir Pitt's sister, old Miss Crawley, had arrived. She possessed £70,000, and you can be sure that her family loved her £70,000 more than they loved her. Her presence always changed things at Queen's Crawley. Sir Pitt was always very polite when his sister came to visit. And his son, Mr. Crawley, even stopped praying at dinner because it annoyed her. And there was Mr. Crawley's brother, Rawdon Crawley. He was totally different from his religious brother. He was a soldier. Captain Rawdon Crawley gambled, flirted, and got into fights. But silly, romantic old Miss Crawley was always ready to pay his debts.
He is young. And that is how young boys should behave, she would say. Not like that hypocrite brother of his, with all of his prayers.
It was well known that old Miss Crawley intended to leave a large part of her fortune to the young, hot-headed Rawdon. So will Becky succeed in winning over these two new people in her life? What strategies will she employ? We are about to find out.